A widening circle of violence, anger, and crisis in the Middle East today. The cry, "Death to America," is being heard once again on the streets of some cities. In addition to the deadly protests in Libya and the destructive unrest in Cairo this week, there have been large demonstrations targeting U.S. embassies and facilities in Yemen, Iran, and Tunisia. This is all said to be motivated by anger over that video produced in the United States of still mysterious origin that denigrated the Prophet Muhammad and has been shared widely on the internet. The attacks in Benghazi at the American consulate there killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other members of his diplomatic team. Joining us now is David Kirkpatrick, Cairo Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
David, the protests geographically seem to be widening, but how do you measure the intensity of such a thing?
For sure it's widening. I think what we're talking about here is a 14-minute videotape, which insults most of all its own maker. I mean, the thing is of low quality, cheap humor. It's not going to be convincing to anyone. It's not even an effective insult. And so I think what really is rumors of this video spread by the Egyptian media among people who haven't seen it that got them all riled up. At the same time, you know, around the Arab world, the U.S. is intensely unpopular and has been for some time because of decades of policy. You know, at the same time, in Libya, there's a great deal of gratitude for U.S. support in the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi. So the events in Libya are in some ways a little bit more confusing. I mean, I think there's some schizophrenia in a lot of these countries towards the U.S., but that schizophrenia is really most pronounced right now in Libya.
So let's talk a little bit about who might have a stake in igniting something like this.
I got to paint the scene in Benghazi for a minute. You've got no police force in Libya and no national army and no real authority. The country is still run by a lot of ad hoc brigades that were formed to overthrow Gaddafi and continue to parade around the streets. The brigade that spearheaded this attack also protects and guards a local hospital and helps with policing duties. They call themselves the supporters of Sharia. I don't know if they have a particularly keen or sharp sense of what they mean by that, but they're Islamist in identity. And when this happened, they decided that in addition to protecting the hospital and keeping the peace, it was their job to try to punish the American consulate. And in that sort of atmosphere where you have all these guns in the streets and all these groups already organized with some military training roaming around, it's not that hard for things to go awry. At the same time, in Benghazi, I think the overwhelming sense, and in Libya in general, the overwhelming sense last night was, oh my gosh, what have we done? You know, we saw Ansar al-Sharia come out the next day and disclaim responsibility to a certain extent for the attacks. You saw the president of Libya bending over backwards to apologize, literally say, I am apologizing to the people of America and the world. And then you saw demonstrations in Benghazi and Tripoli of people coming out to the streets and saying, we are sorry to the American people and expressing their solidarity with Ambassador Stevens, who was immensely popular in Benghazi because of his support for the revolution. It's hard to say that the particular killing of this diplomat is going to have a sort of explosive effect. But I don't fully understand what the consequences are going to be in American politics, where I suspect that enthusiasm for the whole Arab Spring is going to be considerably dampened by this news.
David Kirkpatrick, Cairo Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We will not waver in our commitment to see that justice is done for this terrible act. And make no mistake, justice will be done.
President Obama speaking from the Rose Garden yesterday, reacting to all this. What is a rational or even a useful military response to the violence of this kind targeted directly at U.S. personnel in the middle of a U.S. presidential campaign? A senior U.S. official told CNN that unmanned surveillance drones are now expected to be flying over eastern Libya to look for terrorist encampments and those behind the attacks. Warships have moved closer to Libya in the form of a pair of missile destroyers. Administration officials say they suspect the specific attack was planned, but the spontaneous protests over this anti-Islamic video produced in the U.S. seem to have provided some cover for a premeditated attack by anti-U.S. groups already in Benghazi. Was this a pretext for someone already locked and loaded to attack the U.S., or did U.S. security miss something there in Benghazi? Joining us this morning is Vijay Prashad, author of Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. He's also the chair of South Asian History and director of the International Studies Department at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, joining us from the studios of New England Public Radio. Vijay, welcome to the program.
Good morning, sir.
What do you make of David Kirkpatrick's analysis that this was an opportunistic act by the part of a anti-Gaddafi militia still operating in Benghazi?
Well, the fact is, John, we won't know exactly what happened for a while. But I don't believe that this was entirely an opportunistic action. I think it may have escalated beyond the belief of people who were participating in it. I think they, of course, didn't know the ambassador was in residence. But these kind of actions have been happening throughout this year from January. I mean, in January, a crowd stormed the National Transitional Council office. There's been a pipe bomb in front of the American consulate before. The British embassy, the British consulate in Benghazi, the consular was attacked and they abandoned the embassy over the summer. The United Nations mission has been attacked. So there have been a series of attacks at what are perceived to be Western or Western-backed institutions. And so this is a part of that series. I think it just escalated beyond the previous incidents. And of course, we had the first killing of a U.S. ambassador since 1979. So I doubt very much that this was a planned operation. I think rather it was a part of a series of incidents that went out of control.
Well, we're going to explore the dynamics in places like Libya and other places around the Arab Spring with Vijay Prashad, author of Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. He's the chair of South Asian History and director of international studies at Trinity College. He's staying with us. We want your takeaways, of course. Give us a call.
This is Gordon, J.D., Florida. Americans are terribly naive and ignorant about the emotions of people abroad and their attitudes towards the U.S., etc. It's a terrible loss for this ambassador. It's an ignorant loss by the people who published that documentary. You know, censorship is censorship, but when you're going to inflame foreign cultures and cause death, I'm simply not that democratic.
What's your takeaway about all of this? Do you agree with that listener? Should the movie that we spoke about that seems to have motivated this violence be exempt from the protections of free speech? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What are the dynamics of the violence we're seeing around the Middle East targeted at U.S. facilities in Libya, in Cairo, in Tunisia, and Tehran? Yemen, also the site of some of this violence today. Vijay Prashad is author of Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. He's also the chair of South Asian History and director of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. What are the models, Vijay? I'm thinking 1979 Iran, where a liberation movement turned very quickly into an anti-American initiative. And I also, you know, a diplomat died, and that touched off World War I nearly a century ago. What do we make of the virulence of this violence here?
Well, it's a very good question to ask about analogies, particularly Iran in 78-79. But something has really changed in the last 30 years. There's been a development of a sense of maybe confidence among sections of working class and people who have been rather set aside in society, marginalized in society. And this section, which is a demographic majority and also very young, has felt over the last maybe decade or so that they need to have some place in the world. You know, it's not a question simply of fighting against imperialism. That was the framework of the 1979 uprising, you know, where the Shah was seen essentially as standing in for the United States. Now there's a feeling among this younger population, this much more radicalized population, that they want to say at the table. And a section of them have taken refuge in the ideas of Islamism, you know, the politics of a kind of modern Islam. And they have found a very difficult time creating a political outlet in their societies. You know, many of them, many of the generation of people who are now in their early 40s and below, they have been imprisoned for very long stretches of time. They have been conveniently called terrorists. And they have therefore found, in a sense, no place to put forward a legitimate political view. And this is a kind of situation that I think we didn't consider during the high point of the Arab Spring. There was indeed a very naive story being told about people who were Western educated, you know, the entire a Libyan diaspora, for instance, people like Mahmoud Jibril, people like the recently elected, in fact, just on the day of the attack on the consulate in Benghazi, Mustafa Abu Shagur, who's elected as the new prime minister in Libya. You know, these are Western educated men. We've assumed that if the dictator is overthrown, if Gaddafi is overthrown, well, the next phase will be these Western educated men from the Libyan diaspora. They'll come in and settle things. But below them, there are very large sections of people who have been politically marginalized and are refusing to allow themselves to be second fiddle to people like Jibril, Abu Shagur, and the outgoing Prime Minister El-Kaib. And I think we need to understand that very seriously, rather than immediately go back to our old story of saying that, well, they're just terrorists and we need to respond to them with Tomahawk missiles and with Marines right on the ground.
Well, Vijay, I want to move to the media story here in a moment, but quickly assess for us, Vijay Prashad is author of Arab Spring and Libyan Winter, the demonstrations that happened almost immediately after the death of this ambassador saying, oh, my God, we're sorry, we overreached here. Are they significant?
Well, of course they're significant. I mean, it plays to the fact that there is a political disagreement on the so-called Arab street. There is not one view in Libya. There is not one view in Egypt. There is a contest over views. But we shouldn't exaggerate either side. In other words, it's not worth saying, well, the real Libyans are appalled or the real Libyans are celebrating. Hmm. There is a contradiction in Libyan society, and we need to see it like that.
Vijay Prashad is author of Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. He's the chair of South Asian History and director of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford. Contribute to this conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You're listening to The Takeaway. Vijay, this is a media story in the sense that a film of almost obscene, intentional insult to Islam through the internet has created a widespread feeling of threat in certain quarters of the Arab world. In 2006, there was a similar incident that took down an Italian installation in Benghazi. What do you make of the media dynamics that seem to be driving this particular story this week?
Well, yes, indeed. In 2006, there was the Danish cartoon controversy, and now there's this film. In both cases, there was an important role played by what one might call the Salafi satellites. You know, these are satellite television shows on channels like Al-Nas, which means the people, where there's a certain ideology, a Takfiri Salafi ideology, very sort of virulent ideology of Islam. But that's not the main point. The main point is it's not about the cartoon. It's not about a 13-minute trailer from a very poor film. It's that these things spur on older narratives of humiliation, older feelings of being, you know, considered lesser. One has to keep in mind that the Egyptian uprising, for instance, last year was pushed by forces that had protested the Iraq war in 2003, that had taken a lead role in giving solidarity to the Second Intifada of the Palestinians. You know, the main group that came into Tahrir Square was Kafia and all the number groups, you know, the April group, March
right, group. Right.
These refer to demonstrations. So there's a broad sense of fighting against humiliation, which we really need to understand. It's not just the film.
But Vijay, and we're speaking with Vijay Prashad, who's the author of Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. You know, some people are going to get from this argument that you're advancing here a sense of tolerance of, well, these people are so humiliated that we should understand that they need to go out and kill some ambassadors every once in a while. How do you avoid the sense that you're tolerating an inevitable sense of backlash against the United States?
Well, no, you know, there's a difference between trying to do an analysis of a situation and promoting the outcome of a situation. I mean, my feeling is that we need to understand why something has happened and then produce a prognosis of what might be better tactics to deal with humiliation. So, for instance, in Libya, during the election in July, the rules that were set were so strict that they didn't allow the political Islamists to have any chance of gaining a political foothold in their new society. You know, two-thirds of the seats were reserved for so-called independent candidates.
Who was responsible for that? Who was responsible for that? Because I really want to know.
This is a very good question. It was essentially the leadership of the National Transitional Council, the bulk of whom are men of the Libyan diaspora who had taken power thanks to backing from the NATO intervention. But they don't have as substantial an organized base on the ground. So if there are no political opportunities for these kind of viewpoints, these viewpoints of, say, humiliation, they will find a very disturbing and dangerous outcome. To prevent that outcome, we need to find a way for them to have a seat at the political table.
So political participation also, is there an economic dimension here in that people's cost of living stake in the economic society in Libya needs to grow?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the great scandals of the Gaddafi administration is from the 1980s, there was a downturn in the sharing of oil revenue. You know, in the first 15 years of after his coup in 69, they shared oil revenue, and then the social fabric of Libya increased, you know, up to about 86. There's been a grievous downturn, and there's an expectation now among the people that their well-being is going to once more improve. But there's a lot of doubt about this because they fear that sweetheart deals are going to be cut between the new leadership and the oil companies, and they'll be cut out of them.
A reweaving of the social fabric necessary in Libya, according to Vijay Prashad, author of Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. He's the chair of South Asian History and director of international studies at Trinity College, Hartford. Thanks so much, Vijay.
Thank you very much.